It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's the building of America on the concepts of life, liberty, and the pursuit of salt. That Boston Tea Party could have easily been a Boston Salt Party. Our guest is Professor Pierre Laszlo, author of Salt, Grain of Life. While the Stearns are into Chicago nostalgia at Harry Carey's, beer guy Stephen Beaumont has a great idea for a road trip. It's called Follow That Brew. He of the golden palate, David Rosengarten, riffs on the world-class cuisine America ignores. Then it's trying to get a family recipe from your East Indian fiancé's clan and ending up with more family than recipe. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. ਜਿਹੜਾ ਨੱਚਦੀਆਂ ਕੁੜੀਆਂ ਦੇ ਲੱਕ ਮਿਣਦਾ ਜਿਹੜਾ ਹੱਸਦੀਆਂ ਕੁੜੀਆਂ ਦੇ ਦੰਦ ਗਿਣਦਾ ਜਿਹੜਾ ਨੱਚਦੀਆਂ ਕੁੜੀਆਂ ਦੇ ਲੱਕ ਮਿਣਦਾ ਜਿਹੜਾ ਹੱਸਦੀਆਂ ਕੁੜੀਆਂ ਦੇ ਦੰਦ ਗਿਣਦਾ ਹੋਣਾ ਸੋਹਣਾ ਜਿਹਾ ਉਹਦਾ ਕੋਈ ਨਾ ਨੀ ਭਾਬੀ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਦੱਸ ਪੁੱਛ ਕੇ ਨੀ ਭਾਬੀ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਦੱਸ ਪੁੱਛ ਕੇ ਨੀ ਭਾਬੀ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਦੱਸ ਪੁੱਛ ਕੇ
ਉਹਨੂੰ ਕਹਿ ਦੇ ਹੋਰ ਬੋਲੀਆਂ ਪਾਵੇ ਨਾ ਜੱਗ ਚੰਦਰੇ ਤੋਂ ਨਜ਼ਰ ਕੁੜੀਆਂ ਦੇ ਦੰਦ ਗਿਣਦਾ, ਜਿਹੜਾ ਨੱਚਦੀਆਂ ਕੁੜੀਆਂ ਦੇ ਲੱਕ ਮਿਣਦਾ, ਜਿਹੜਾ ਹੱਸਦੀਆਂ ਕੁੜੀਆਂ ਦੇ ਦੰਦ ਗਿਣਦਾ, ਹੋਣਾ ਸੋਹਣਾ ਜਿਹਾ ਉਹਦਾ ਕੋਈ ਨਾ ਨੀ ਭਾਬੀ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਦੱਸ ਪੁੱਛ ਕੇ, ਨੀ ਭਾਬੀ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਦੱਸ ਪੁੱਛ ਕੇ, ਨੀ ਭਾਬੀ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਦੱਸ ਪੁੱਛ ਕੇ।
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's White Gold, the building of America on the concepts of life, liberty, and the power of salt. Our guest is salt expert and chemistry professor Pierre Laszlo. His book is Salt, Grain of Life. We have a great travel idea. It's Follow That Brew with beer expert Stephen Beaumont. Next, it's an American travesty, the world-class cuisine we totally ignore. Taste maven David Rosengarten talks the flavors of India. And as always, in the second half of the show, we are going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's start with the original culinary roadies, Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet magazine. So Jane, Michael, where have you been? Where's the latest trip?
We have been back to my hometown, Chicago, eating at one of my favorite restaurants there. And it's a real restaurant, not a hot dog stand. We're talking about Harry Carey's restaurant on the north side of the Loop. Harry Carey, of course, you remember, was the voice of the Chicago Cubs for umpteen and then some years. Before that, he announced for the Chicago White Sox and the St. Louis Cardinals. He really was the quintessential baseball fan. Towards the end of his career, he opened Harry Carey's restaurant, which, unlike any other sports bar type of place I've ever been to, serves really great regional Chicago food.
Harry Carey was known for his cry of amazement at ball games, saying, "Holy cow!" And this kind of is echoed in the restaurant. For one thing, there's a large plaster replica of a cow with holes cut in it, so it looks like kind of a big cow and Swiss cheese combination. But they serve fabulous steaks. But what we love Harry Carey's for is it's one of the few bastions of real Chicago foods, things like chicken Vesuvio or shrimp de jong, foods that were invented in Chicago and alas are not served in many places anymore.
So what, chicken Vesuvio and shrimp de jong? I'm not going to let you go here. What are we talking about?
Chicken Vesuvio, nobody knows exactly how it got its name, except when it is served, it looks somewhat like a volcano in the sense that it is whole pieces of chicken that are garlic roasted along with garlic roasted potatoes and a few peas for color. And they're piled up in a sort of a volcano shape on a plate. It's really kind of luscious food because it is very long roasted and the chicken develops a kind of dark red gold crust of skin that just kind of slides off the meat if you just poke it with a fork.
I was going to say it's marinated in white wine, but I almost want to say it's laminated in white wine because it's got this patina to it that is so delicious. And shrimp de jong is kind of a Chicago twist on shrimp scampi. It's basically the ingredients are just big, snapping, fresh, wonderful shrimp, tons of garlic, butter and breadcrumbs and some sherry. And I don't know why they just taste so much better in Harry Carey's restaurant than anywhere else that we've had them.
Is it a big place?
It's a huge place. It's actually, the place itself is magnificent. It's an 1895 Dutch Renaissance-style limestone building right by the river. I mean, a kind of palace in the middle of Chicago.
In the National Registry of Historic Places, it's a beautiful building.
It is. And in fact, during the 1930s, Frank Nitti, Al Capone's henchman, lived on the fourth floor. It was kind of his hideout. So it's got an interesting history. The dining rooms now are these kind of wonderful, how to describe, sort of men's club mahogany and white linen type steakhouse furnishings.
A place where they give you big knives to eat with, which is always a sign of a good steakhouse. Now, let me see if I get this right, Michael. The length of the bar at Harry...
The length of the bar in Harry Carey's barroom is exactly the length from the pitcher's rubber to home plate in a Major League Baseball stadium. 60 feet, 6 inches long.
Now, this is not to say that Harry Carey was any sort of a cook himself. In fact, we met his widow, who's a lovely woman named Dutchie Carey, and she said that he would, when he was hungry, he would go to the refrigerator and just stand in front of it and not know, you know, not even sort of figuring out how to open the door. So she was always feeding him. And finally,
he loved to eat.
He just was not a cook himself, but he certainly knew, he knew how to build a good restaurant and how to hire good help.
I'm picturing one end of the bar is higher than the other.
It's and the of course,
no.
you know, to slide a beer mug down that long bar, that's an art form unto itself.
But you couldn't slide a beer mug down the bar because it is set with Harry Carey's homemade potato chips, which are really very much like the old-fashioned Saratoga chips, a little bit thicker than normal potato chips. Impossible to stop eating.
They make them fresh every hour. They are so good.
Hey, guys. We're off to Chicago again.
Right. Holy cow.
Holy cow. Thanks. Bye.
Quite a guy. Well, Jane and Michael Stern's latest book in their road food series is Louie's Backyard Cookbook. Jane Stern's new book is Ambulance Girl. Now, every week they come by with a report, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just head for the website, splendidtable.org. Authority Stephen Beaumont is the author of The Premium Beer Drinker's Guide. Now, he treks the entire globe hunting down great brews, but I'm thinking about trekking here at home. Maybe a beer trip. Hey, Steve, it's good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn. Nice to be back.
So, Steve, are there some great beer areas in the United States that we should think about visiting?
Well, you know, it is actually a great time to be a beer traveler within the U.S. And one of the real strong emerging areas is the general region I call the Mid-Atlantic, kind of defined by a newspaper around those parts that covers the area, the Mid-Atlantic Brewing News. And the heart of that, without question, is Philadelphia.
Oh, so this is a real beer town. Huh.
Philadelphia is a great beer town. I actually refer to it. They have the Schuylkill River flows by Philadelphia, and I refer to Philadelphia as Brussels on the Schuylkill because the Belgian influence there is so pronounced. It's absolutely tremendous. And one of the hallmarks of that is actually not a brewery at all, but a restaurant called Monk's Cafe, which features not only some great Belgian-influenced cuisine, but also probably the widest selection of beers you're going to get in the Mid-Atlantic area.
Now, are those beers generally made in the Philadelphia area, or are they imports?
There's a combination, really. One of the owners is a fellow named Tom Peters, who's really passionate about Belgium. So he brings in a lot of Belgian beers. But, you know, all in that same area, there's breweries like Victory Brewing Company up just north of Philadelphia, and they do a beer called Golden Monkey, which is a great Belgian-style strong ale. There's another brewery in Philadelphia itself, unfortunately not a brew pub, but their beers are available all around the city, and it's called Yards. And they do a couple of Belgian-influenced beers. One's called Trouble de Yards, which they call it Trouble because it's halfway between a Belgian-style double and a triple. And they also do a beer called their Yards Belgian Saison, which is a nice interpretation of that style.
So you can find these beers in the restaurants and the pubs and that kind of thing around town.
There are a lot of great beer destinations in Philadelphia. In addition to Monk's, Belgian-influenced places in the Old City, there's the Eulogy Belgian Tavern. And up in the Northern Liberties, there's the Abbey, which is another new place. And a more kind of localized beer bar, which is a terrific place to eat, as the Standard Tap, also up in the Northern Liberties District.
What about the area around Philadelphia, getting out into the suburbs and the countryside?
You know, one of the old great craft breweries in the eastern United States is Stout's Brewing Company. And they're up in Adamstown, just in Pennsylvania Dutch country. They do some wonderful lagers, also into the Belgian styles themselves, and some American ales, American-style ales as well. And, of course, up in Pottsville, just to the north, the oldest brewery in the United States, Youngling Brewing Company.
That's where the oldest brewing company is? In Pottsville?
That's it.
Huh. I would have thought it was New York or someplace like that.
Pottsville, PA.
So now, as far as pairing food with these things, I mean, are people doing a lot of beer and food pairing in these places, or is it just a matter of the beers there on the menu?
I think you see a lot of food and beer pairing, especially at places like Monk's and Eulogy, where you have that great Belgian influence. You know, I didn't even mention Pittsburgh. There's actually several really nice breweries over in Pittsburgh. And one that's really fascinating is a brew pub called the Church Brew Works. And that's actually built into an old church. And they specialize in seasonals. They can have up to 12 seasonals on tap at any one time. And there's always something to go with whatever you want to order in the way of food there.
So Pittsburgh is another great beer town. Other breweries there?
Yeah, Penn Brewing Company, or Pennsylvania Brewing Company, known as the Penn Brewery. They do some great Germanic-style lagers out there, including a dark one called Penn Dark, which you don't see. It's just not a style you see in the U.S. a lot.
Well, Stephen, this is a great way to plan a trip. Do it around beer and head for Pennsylvania. Thank you very much.
It's called beer traveling, Lynn, and it's been a pleasure.
Well, Stephen Beaumont is author of The Premium Beer Drinker's Guide, the world's strongest, boldest, and most unusual beers. Now, you can find his travel and beer tips on the website, splendidtable.org. And just to balance the summer sipping for those of us who don't want the alcohol, I've got two ideas for you. Now, these are improvisations. You do them to your own taste. The first one is raspberry iced tea. And it's fabulous. It's so easy. You take about a cup of raspberries and you put it into 5 to 6 cups of cold tea. Now, with a wooden spoon, you just kind of mash that to get that raspberry juice into the tea. And then you serve it over ice, you sweeten it to taste, and a shot of lemon. It just brings up the flavor. Now, the second idea is a new take on the Latino mojito. You do it without the rum. Take a large pitcher, put into it a big handful of mint, about a half a cup of sugar. Take that wooden spoon again and kind of mash them together. It's called muddling. And the idea is you want to smell the mint. Then you add to that the juice of 5 or 6 limes. You pour in a ton of club soda. You mix it, taste it for sweetness and for lime, pour it over ice. You're there. Couldn't be easier. Coming up, White Gold, the story of salt and power in America, a quick India fix from David Rosengarten, and open lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Salt is quite the thing these days. We can decide which sea we would like our salt from, which color, or which flavor tickles our fancy. A handful can go for a few cents or many dollars. Now, all this seems to be very new. but it isn't. According to Professor Pierre Laszlo, salt was white gold. It was like money. The ruler who monopolized salt raised fortunes in salt taxes. Salt trade built economic models that are still at work today. Now, Professor Laszlo is a former emeritus professor of chemistry at the University of Liège in Belgium. He is a salt researcher, and he's author of Salt, Grain of Life. Pierre, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, you know, I'd like to talk about salt and power, but first, could you explain to us why salt is so essential to human beings?
Well, the body needs it, and basically this is because animal life originated in the ocean. It is an antiseptic, which leads to its role in food preservation, in many kinds of food. So each one of us needs between 3 and 5 grams of salt daily, which is a huge amount, which leads to what you are talking about in terms of politics and power.
Uh-huh. Well, now let's look at the cultural role of food, how it plays in cultures older than ours. You told me a story about a festival in France. Could you relate that, please?
Oh, yes. There's a small village in France named Moncrabeau, M-O-N-C-R-A-B-E-A-U. And in this village, they have a yearly tournament of liars. So people rival in this contest in telling tall tales. There is a jury wearing costumes, and there is a goat also to symbolize that since people will be telling lies, this is equivalent to inviting the devil. 2 village children are dressed all in white, and they get in front of each jury member in turn with a little bag, and the member who has just heard a tall tale from one of the contestants pours with a spoon an amount of coarse salt from a supply on the lap in proportion to the appreciation of the story. And at the end of the proceedings, each of the bags are weighed, and the one who is the heaviest is that of a winner.
So you're actually, your prize is salt.
Your prize is salt, which points to the very high monetary value of salt in past times. And also there is a symbolical role of salt in this whole thing, because since the devil is present, you better have something as a purification symbol, which salt has been from times immemorial, because it is white and because it kills germs, which is the origin, for instance, for casting salt over the shoulder in order to ward off the devil.
Well, that's right. If you think you're in a dangerous situation, you throw salt over your shoulder.
That's right.
Well, I realize that in Europe for a very, very long time, salt has equated with power. But I'd like to look at America's relationship with salt, because you talk about it being quite different.
It is. It is indeed. As with any feature of America, you have to start with a huge expanse of land. And therefore, you needed local production centers to fuel the westward migration, which has been an integral part of American history. Also, very early on, salt routes became erased from memory because Indians were pushed aside from where the white man was settling. And the reason for America being different is that after independence in 1776, there was no salt tax, because indeed, the salt tax was something abhorrent, which the colonists got rid of. You may recall that independence started with the Seven Years' War. At that time, the British crown borrowed heavily from British and Dutch bankers in order to fund this Seven Years' War, which doubled the national debt between 1756 and 1776 for Britain. And therefore, the British king levied a much heavier salt tax on the American colonies. And this salt tax was one of the reasons why the colonists revolted.
So you mean the Boston Tea Party could have been a Boston salt party just as
absolutely,
easily?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So, Pierre, are there any modern examples in America of salt and power at this point?
Well, clearly, one of the worldwide leaders of the chemical industry is Dow Chemical, which is the number one chemical company in the world. And Dow Chemical made its wealth, made its power, with the very huge deposits of salt in Michigan. For instance, the city of Detroit, underneath it, has huge salt mines.
Oh, really?
Which is too little known, yes. So they run electricity through brine, and in this manner, they produce, on one hand, caustic soda, and on the other hand, they produce chlorine. And these are very important commodities from which much of the everyday chemicals we need are being made. An example, a prime example, would be vinyl chloride. Vinyl chloride from which the PVC plastic is being made. Vinyl has been used for records. Vinyl has been used for roofing, for tubing, for piping. And indeed, in my book, I equate the Eisenhower era with the age of vinyl.
Ah.
Vinyl tiling and vinyl fixtures. And this was the time of the Howard Johnson. In the American landscape, you would see everywhere with their little red roof, which was made of vinyl tiles. And you'd sit in front of a vinyl mat on a vinyl seat.
So all
and
of this
all
starts
of that stemmed from the production of chlorine by Dow Chemical, which became a very wealthy corporation at that time.
And all started with salt.
All started with salt, indeed.
Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome.
Well, Pierre Laszlo is former Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at the University of Liège in Belgium and the École Polytechnique in Paris. He is author of Salt, Grain of Life. David Rosengarten is a cookbook author, wine expert, TV chef, and creator of the Rosengarten Report, a food and wine newsletter. I call him the man of the golden palate. David tastes, David evaluates, and David tells all. David, welcome back.
I have a lot of gold fillings. Is that what you mean? No.
Well, where has the palate taken you recently?
Oh, the palate has taken me to India. Are you a lover of Indian food?
I am. I don't know a lot about it, but I love the flavors.
Oh, my God. They're so bright and vivid. And the funny thing is that in the U.S., most people don't know a lot about it, don't go to Indian restaurants. And as you know, in other English-speaking countries like England, there's an Indian restaurant on every corner. It's like Chinese restaurants or pizzerias here. We would love Indian food, is my contention, if we knew more about it. It's a fabulous world-class cuisine.
Well, I have a premise, though. I think a lot of us don't have access to great Indian restaurants, so we've got to figure out what to do at home. And this is where you come in.
Yes. Well, in this article that I researched for the Rosengarten Report, I tasted hundreds of Indian ingredients from five major purveyors. So this stuff is really easy to get at your house. This is all mail order direct. And I came up with a whole series of things that you can have on your doorstep tomorrow that are awfully easy to use at home. And it's awfully easy to make Indian food. There's not a lot of high technique involved.
Okay. So where do we begin?
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we talk about those things that are the easiest of all, like all you have to do basically is open the bag.
This is
because
easy.
Because they will enrich your gastronomic life, I promise you. For example, listen, I eat tortilla chips and I have the occasional potato chip and so on and so forth, but I contend that the most exciting snacks in the world, and very often in Indian venues like Indian restaurants, they serve these snacks with drinks right before the start of the meal, and you can do this at home at your party. These are the Indian snacks. They're amazing. Most of them are made from, they're crisps made from chickpea flour, but there's also added to them all the time fried legumes, nuts, raisins, fried noodles, all kinds of things, all blended with incredible Indian spices. And I have one in particular that I can recommend if you wish.
Sure.
The company that makes it is called Shamiana. Sounds like a rock band from the... No. Shamiana, and the specific name of this product, because they make a couple, is Navrang N-A-V-R-A-N-G, mm-hmm. Chevda, C-H-E-V-D-A. It says in my report, the lightest, most elegant, flakiest, frilliest of all, with startling flavors from all over the subcontinent, including a southern curry leaf taste and a Bengali mustard-like taste. And you could get this stuff from Kalustians, which is a big store in New York and also a mail-order distributor.
Okay.
And they have fabulous products.
All right, so we've got a snack. What's
next? You got a snack.
Okay.
Also, alongside your Indian meal, you want to serve what they call chutneys and pickles. And Indian pickles is a really interesting category that nobody knows anything about. They're not garlic dill pickles. They're nothing like our pickles. They're slices usually of lemon or lime or mango sitting in a kind of hot, spicy, salty oil. And they just pick up these wild, spicy flavors, and they're absolutely terrific with chicken tandoori and other things. And once again, it is Kalustian in New York that I think has the very best line of mail-order pickles and chutneys.
Okay, so it's pickles and chutneys. Do you have a particular one or two you want us to try?
I sure do. If you're the very best pickle that I tasted is made by Kalustian. They're not just selling somebody else's. They make it. They pack it. It's called Kalustian's homemade lime pickle. And I also like Kalustian's hot mango chutney. And I should point out to you, Lynn, that if you want to make Indian food at home, other than the Rosengarten Report, there's a couple of great books out there that you can buy that will really get you going.
Which are?
Well, you want to buy anything by Madhur Jaffrey.
Mm-hmm.
You want to buy anything by Julie Sani. But here's two books that I found recently. One is called Great Curries of India, which is a fabulous book that has lots about Indian technique, about how to do this stuff, as well as some great recipes. And another is called The Indian Grocery Store Demystified, which is a wonderful book from Linda Bladholm that tells you everything you need to know about hundreds and hundreds of Indian ingredients.
Well, as usual, you have covered the waterfront. David,
okay.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
David Rosengarten's Food and Wine newsletter is the Rosengarten Report. Now, you can get information on the newsletter and his recipe for pilau rice with saffron and fresh curry leaves on the website, splendidtable.org. There's this constant in life. Start tracking down a family recipe, and inevitably it ends up being more about the family than the recipe. The people take over, and the food kind of follows along, as reporter Anne Marie Ruff discovered recently.
India would probably be the best place to learn to cook Indian food, but I went to Fairfield, California to learn. That's because Fairfield is where my Indian boyfriend's sister, Rani, lives with her husband, Tony. Rani was well prepared for my visit with piles of fresh spinach from the farmer's market to make saag. Saag is one of my favorite Punjabi dishes, so I didn't mind that we had to clean all the greens.
And we put everything in pressure cooker?
Pressure cooker.
With jalapenos and onions?
Yes.
And garlic.
And garlic. And some ginger.
Okay. All fresh.
All fresh.
Okay.
Tony and I ran an errand while the spinach steamed. When we got back, Rani said we needed to stop in on Tony's aunt for a pot of afternoon chai. So we left the saag safely cooked in the pressure cooker and headed out. Tony's aunt, everyone calls her Panji, which means aunt in Punjabi, has a reputation for making excellent chai.
Okay, so this is the secret to chai, to good chai.
I don't want to tell anybody because this is my secret.
But you will have to tell her.
I'm just joking.
Yeah. She usually would never give her recipes away.
Oh, really?
She would never. See,
so she
secret.
Won't even. She shows me the jar, but not the label on the jar, so I can't see what it.
I think cardamom.
I managed to discern that Panji's secret recipe is ground green cardamom, cloves, fennel seeds, and Lipton tea bags with just a bit of milk. As soon as Rani cut up a Sara Lee cake fresh from the freezer, we were ready for our chai. Just then, another set of guests arrived at the door.
Long time after kids, you remember all that.
With eight people, seven of them Punjabis, we had reached the point of no return. Rani whispered to me that we wouldn't be able to leave. We would have to stay for dinner. Our saag would have to wait. In the kitchen, it was obvious to see that this was probably Panji's plan all along. There was chicken in the oven and sog on the stove. The benefit of Panji's menu was that my cooking lesson continued. To the steamed greens, you add tarka.
And the tarka, the fried stuff?
Is onions and garlic. And some green peppers.
Green chilies.
Green chilies and coriander leaves.
Okay, and so we add the fried vegetables, the tarka, to the boiled greens.
Yes.
And that's sog.
That's sog.
Okay. And we're not eating our sog at home.
No, because Sonia Panji would not let us go home.
So we have to eat her sog.
We have to eat her sog today. Sorry.
And this is the same in any culture, that all the women are in the kitchen
and all the men are
in the living room. This is the same in every culture.
Why don't you go and ask them why is it?
In addition to my cooking lesson, I got a lesson in gender politics. Despite appearances, Panji's husband Virji, which means uncle, had actually cooked half of the food we would eat. And he claimed that he was actually the one who taught his wife to cook when they were first married.
She don't know how to make sabji or how to make a fulka. She don't know nothing. I show her how to make it.
Then he
still, she is not a perfect. Still, it's true. She's not perfect, you know.
She's okay.
I'm going to go and confirm this now. I'm going to go and ask. Panji, your husband says that when you were married and you went to England to live with him, you didn't know how to make roti.
He's telling lie.
No rotis.
Good cook.
What?
I'm very good cook.
Okay.
Yeah.
I watch for it.
Wherever Panji learned to cook, she learned well. Her oven fulkas were perfectly round and her sog was delicious. I figured we would get to our sog the next day. But the next day, we went to the Gurdwara, the Sikh temple, for services. Any Punjabi will tell you that integral to services at the Gurdwara is the communal longer meal afterward.
We're not eating sog for lunch.
No, tonight for dinner for sure.
So what are we eating?
We had kofta, alu gobi, dal, raita, and roti.
And
lemon pickle.
And who
I was starting to realize that food is inherent in any Punjabi gathering. But before I could eat our sog, I would learn that being social is synonymous with being Punjabi. With every intention of eating sog for dinner that night, I headed into San Francisco with Ronnie, Tony, and their friends. But remember what I said about food being integral to any Punjabi gathering? So, of course, on Fisherman's Wharf, we had to stop for a snack in the least Punjabi of places, Johnny Rockets.
We had all done.
Guys, have some fries at least.
Back at Ronnie's that night, our sog waited patiently on the stove to be eaten. But our stomachs were full with fries, and we were engrossed in one of the climatic episodes of the TV show Bachelor. The goading and cheering from four people in arranged marriages quickly pushed all thoughts of food from our minds. It wasn't until the next morning, with 15 minutes left, before I would leave to catch a train out of Fairfield, that I was finally able to eat Ronnie's sog for breakfast. It was delicious. My apologies to Panji, but Ronnie's sog was even better than hers. And as I ate, I quizzed Ronnie about what the secret ingredient was, what exotic Indian spice passed from Punjabi mother to daughter made her sog melt in my mouth with just the right balance of flavors. Ronnie's answer? Salt. Lots of salt. Some things are the same in every culture. For the Splendid Table, this is Anne-Marie Ruff.
Salt. Again. Reporter Anne-Marie Ruff is based in Abu Dhabi. Now, after all that, we had to find you a recipe for sog. We went to Raghavan Iyer, author of Turmeric Trail, to get his take on sog. Now, Raghavan says sog means greens, and his sog recipe is for mustard greens with chili. It's dynamite. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, you better brush up your Latin because the question is, what is cenosilicophobia? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a minute. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is cenosilicophobia? Well, the word comes from ceno, which means empty, silica, which means glass, and phobia, which means fear. Cenosilicophobia means the fear of an empty glass. Now, I have not been able to find any record of the psychiatric community treating this phobia, but you know that some attorney is going to tell a judge, my client hijacked the Coors truck because he's a victim of cenosilicophobia. Now, if you want to choose your very own fear, here is our foodie's phobia list. Fear of dining or dinner conversations is diepnophobia. Fear of drinking is dipsophobia. Fear of garlic is alliumphobia. And here is the one for everyone who has had it with kitchen duty, magiricophobia, which is the fear of cooking.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. We have got David on the line. Hey, David, what do you want to talk about?
I want to hear something about yucca.
Yucca?
Absolutely. I live in a little southern town where nothing ever changes. And the other day we wandered into a grocery store, and here was this enormous bin, and it said yucca on the sign. And I asked what it was, and they said, we don't have the slightest idea.
What did it look like?
It looks like a sweet potato with bark on the outside.
Right, yes. And some people pronounce it yucca and other people pronounce it yucca. I never remember which is correct.
What? Is this the same thing that we see blooming around all the time that has the big head of white blossoms on it?
You know what? I've never seen one growing. You're lucky enough to live in the South.
Oh, of course I am. That is lucky, honey.
Oh, yeah. Where are you in the South, by the way?
Gallatin, Tennessee, just a little way out of Nashville.
Oh, that's heavenly country.
Of course it's heavenly.
And you've got great hams, right?
Oh, you bet. Oh, mercy.
Oh, all right, we got to talk about yucca yucca.
Right, absolutely.
Okay, what you have got there is one of the great staples of Latin America and the Caribbean and even parts of Asia.
It's got several names. Cassava. Have you ever heard of cassava?
Oh, of course I have.
Well, that's another name for it. Manioc is still another. This is the plant that gives us tapioca.
Of course.
So what you do is you have to peel it, and the best way, you have to cook it before you eat it. That's the whole point. Now, the best way, because it is a bark, to peel it is you actually make long slits down the side. And for those who have never seen this, it can be quite long, like 15 inches or more long. And it looks like either a carrot on steroids or a sweet potato on a diet.
Right.
Yeah. And you make long slits, and then you peel away that bark. And if you have to and you can really almost slice it away. And if there's pink still there on the flesh, you want to just use a vegetable peeler to get rid of that. Cut it into chunks, and you want to simmer it. Salted water, figure maybe 3 quarts of water for every 2 pounds, something like that. You cook it for about 15 minutes or until it shouldn't go to mush. It should be tender enough that you can stick a knife into it and it feels tender. Let it sit in the turn off the heat after about 15 minutes when it's tender like that. Let it sit for another 10 minutes or so and then dry it in a towel. And you can serve it in chunks, you can mash it, and it's got this buttery, it's bland, but it's really appealing. It has an underlying sweetness and a slight butteriness.
Good.
And it's wonderful with any...
Oh, it sounds so good. I'm looking forward.
You know what you can do? You take fresh lemon or lime and chilies and salt, okay? And you mash up that cooked up yucca, and you sprinkle it with that combination.
Sounds fantastic. Bless your heart.
Well, thank you, sir.
I love your program. Do you know the German proverb about eating, lieber den Magen verrenken als den Wirt verschenken?
No.
It's better to ruin your stomach than leave anything for the landlord. Is that not wonderful?
That is absolutely fabulous.
I love it. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you. I wish I could hang out in his kitchen. Does he not sound like a fabulous guy? It's yucca or yuca. And the other thing that's fabulous is you cut it into pieces, you drop it, you cut it into thin slices, you drop it in water, let it sit for a little while, take it out, pat it dry, and you deep fry it. And there is nothing in the world like it. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next? We've got Liner up. Hey, Liner, welcome.
Hey, Lynn, it's Liner. How are you?
I am just fine. I did pronounce your name correctly, right?
Absolutely. Well, absolutely.
What is on your mind?
Well, I am moving to a lovely little city called St. Paul, Minnesota. I think you've heard of it.
Yes, I'm sitting in the middle of it right now.
There you go. Well, see, I'm getting myself a housewarming gift called a pepper grinder.
Uh-huh.
I love fresh ground pepper, but are all pepper grinders, I don't know, made alike, or how do I know what I'm getting?
Oh, yeah, great question. This could change the course of your life as you know it.
Yeah.
Okay, I think when it comes to pepper grinders, mm-hmm. I've got one word for you.
Okay.
Peugeot.
Excuse me?
Yeah, I know. Well, they used to make cars.
Oh, okay.
They had a lot of trouble with the cars, but okay. The pepper grinders that they make never die. The sign of a great pepper grinder is that you can keep adjusting it, you know, from coarse to fine,
right,
5 years after you buy it.
Mm-hmm.
When you actually grind with it, you actually get pepper, because some of these babies who look really pretty, mm-hmm. you turn and turn and turn and nothing happens.
Right.
And that it's, you know, that the grinding mechanism stays really sharp. And I've been through a ton of them. I know there are other brands that are probably good. I have had my Peugeot grinders. One is 20 years old.
Oh, my.
The other one is 5 years old. Okay. I can still do coarse, medium, and fine. And they're easy to handle. And they're dynamite. So, you know, let's skip to the chase, which is buy a Peugeot pepper grinder.
And be done with it.
And be done with it. And then you don't have to think about anything for the next 10 or 15 years. And welcome to St. Paul.
Well, thank you very much.
Get to the farmer's market downtown.
Oh, absolutely.
You are going to love it.
I cannot wait.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You take care.
You too.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. We've got Karen calling. So, Karen, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I am a mediocre cook, and I love food.
and I'm addicted to your show, and we've been listening to it, and I bought a Asian Wraps cookbook by Nina Simmons.
Oh, yeah, she's great.
Wonderful food in it. And I went, we have a wonderful Asian market. I live in Wichita, Kansas.
Right.
And it's minutes from my house, and so I went, I gathered all my supplies and ingredients, and I was so thrilled to find everything. But there's a Vietnamese sweet and sour dipping sauce for things like the spring rolls and the shrimp fingers.
Yeah, yeah.
And it calls for fish sauce.
Right.
Now, this market is huge. And I asked them fish sauce. There were bunches and bunches of different kinds of fish sauce. And I noticed a lot of them were anchovy-based.
That's right. Yeah, they are.
So, well, and I figured since those were the most prevalent, I should probably go with that one. That is the most awful smelling, horrible. And I made the sweet and sour dipping sauce, and it tasted like when we go to the Thai restaurants, but the odor is just horrendous. And I'm wondering, there were a few different other fish sauces. What? Where do I go with this?
Well, we have good news and we have bad news. First, the bad news is they all are going to smell like that.
Are they?
Yeah, the good news is that's the way they're supposed to be. And the trick is don't take long inhales of them because...
You hold our breath when we eat this. It tastes just like it. It looks just like it. But the odor is just...
I know. What a lot of people, a lot of cooks do is they add a bit of water to this sauce. And you do get that smell. But when you're eating it in a restaurant, one of the reasons you don't get the smell is I'm convinced that they make it well ahead and that smell diminishes. But that fish sauce is made with these dried, sort of fermented in the sun fish. And there is a flavor. I actually think, and there's a lot been written about this, but of course I can't remember the details right now. There's actually a chemical reaction that takes place that actually makes food much more savory. In so many words, what MSG is supposed to do to things? Well, this fermented, dried, salty fish, the result of it, which is the fish sauce, does the same thing. It enhances flavor like nothing else. So know that that aroma of old socks is okay. All right? And I'd say don't inhale deeply.
And is the anchovy base the best to go with? I believe I saw one of octopus, and then there was another fish that I didn't even recognize, and that one was refrigerated.
Yeah, some of them, by the way, I store mine in the fridge, just because you use so little, and it's supposed to keep forever, but I keep it in the fridge just to be on the safe side. I think it's all a matter of personal taste. The one that I use, I think, is anchovy based, and I got this advice from an Asian expert. It has three crabs on the label.
Okay.
There's five crabs. There's three crabs. There's probably four crabs. But this one has three crabs. It's particularly delicate, I think, except, you know, who is going to do an extensive tasting of these things without dying? But I'd say you're safe. You'll also see some are done with shrimp. Mm-hmm. I would say, I mean, I've tried them all, not every brand, but I've tried different types, and I don't find a big difference.
They all smell, but
they all are indispensable when it comes to this area of cooking.
So I can't leave it out.
Nah.
That's something I need.
You need it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You need it.
Well, we're really enjoying the recipes in the book, and that's what I got to go with.
Well, that's you know, you get used to it after a while, believe it or not. And then you get a desire for it. And that's really when it sets in.
Okay.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
Goodbye. And thanks for the kind words.
Bye-bye.
It is something you keep. By the way, a bottle of this stuff is going to last you for years. And I just keep mine on the door of the refrigerator. If you wish to talk to us, all you have to do is dial 800-537-5252. We've got Marjorie calling. Marjorie, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I read a book called Venetian Dreaming.
Ooh, it sounds lovely.
It's like a memoir of living in Venice for a year. And the author talks about going to a cocktail party at the Peggy Guggenheim Museum and having fried sage leaves as an hors d'oeuvre type of food.
Uh-huh.
I wondered if you had any idea how to fry sage leaves.
Basically, it's kind of a classic. It's done in a lot of parts of Italy, and it's just they're delicious. There's essentially two ways that they're done. One is you dip it in a batter, and the other is that you just drop the leaves into oil and let them crisp, which takes seconds, and then you drain them on paper towel and you salt them. If you want to do the batter dips, and that may be what they were serving at a cocktail party, you make a batter of flour and water and a bit of egg. Throw salt and pepper in there. If you want, you can add a little Parmigiano to that.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah. I mean, what could be bad, right? And right. then you just dip, and you only need about a half inch of oil in a shallow pan because they're small, and you put them in the pan. You fry them at about 375, and then drain them really well on paper towel and throw on some extra salt. Now, the other thing I've done is I've actually done them tempura style. And okay. That's great, too.
Tell me about that.
Well, that, I'm trying to remember, because it's been a while. It's ice water, flour, and as I recall, egg white beaten in, no egg yolk, egg white beaten into the mixture. You know, just beaten and then folded in, and then you dip. And you have a lot of stuff sticking to it, you know, and you drop it into the fat. And you use fairly large sage leaves.
But okay.
It's a great time of year because we can get the fresh herbs so easily.
Right. I've got them growing in my yard. And they do have the large leaves on them.
Yeah, that would be a great thing to do. And by the way, when you're done with all that, then you can fry basil.
The same way?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, it's fabulous.
Oh, so there's more than pesto with basil.
There's a world beyond pesto. Yes, but frying basil leaves, it's one of my favorite things.
Oh, I'll have to try that, too.
Hey, enjoy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Take care, Margie.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. One of our favorite people has been honored. You may know this, but the highest award that can be given an American citizen who is not in the military is the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Well, Julia Child has received the Medal of Freedom. Bravo, Julia. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Julia Child. She said, "Life itself is a proper binge." The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. You know, you can find everything you heard here today, and even things you didn't hear today, on our website, splendidtable.org. You can also find our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to make your weeknight cooking a little easier. You register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.